morning, everyone. Okay. Here we go. But before we do, I want to say that we're very honored to have Judge Adelman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin with us today. So you better behave, because he's a district court judge, and he's used to dealing with unruly lawyers. Okay. Appeal 10-14-69, George versus Kraft Foods Global, and it's Mr. Wolf. Morning, Mr. Wolf.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Michael Wolf, the attorney for the plaintiff's appellants in this case. The district court abused its discretion in denying plaintiffs leave to file their first amended complaint because plaintiffs did not unduly delay and defendants would have suffered no prejudice from the amendment. Plaintiffs sought leave to file with 2 months remaining before the deadline for discovery. Only 3 weeks earlier, plaintiffs had received unredacted versions of a massive document production after successfully pursuing a motion to compel. Plaintiffs had not even taken the depositions of defendants' fact witnesses. Defendants did not have to file their expert witness reports for another 4 months. The court had not yet decided class certification and would not do so for another 2 months. The additional claims and parties would not have altered the class certification decision in any case.
Of course, you know that, because you said so, but it's an abuse of discretion standard, and these were issues and claims that you were aware of earlier in the litigation. Isn't that true?
Well, no, Your Honor, that's not true. The claims that we're talking about only were discovered as a result of the document production that the defendants delayed on. Now, it was arguably true that some of the defendants, the added defendants, were known of earlier. But the problem is the standard for the plaintiffs that each time they learn some new thing, they should be serially amending their complaint as they go along? Or is it reasonable for the plaintiffs to wait until they have gotten sufficient information to know the new parties and claims they are seeking to add, and to seek leave to amend at that point, when there's time, ample time left on the discovery schedule? Motion for summary judgment wasn't filed for another year after this was all done, and there's no case that defendants have been able to find in which denial of leave was affirmed or even done by any court under similar circumstances. In the usual case, leave is denied when the plaintiff seeks to amend after the discovery schedule, after discovery cutoff, after dispositive motions are filed, or at or shortly before trial. And that did not happen in this case. Now, the prejudice to the plaintiffs was clear and demonstrated by the facts of the parallel cases. The district judge asked the defendants if they're allowed to file a separate claim, and the judge believed we could file a separate claim as to these new claims. How do you see that spinning out? The defendants did not say, Your Honor, it's claim splitting. If we get a summary judgment in your case, we're going to assert res judicata in the other case and try to knock out both of these cases in one shot.
Of course, they didn't say they wouldn't either.
Correct, Your Honor. But had they been clear with the district court that they saw this as claim splitting and would try to knock out that second case, the district court here would have seen the clear prejudice to plaintiffs and almost certainly would have allowed the amendment of the pleadings to prevent that prejudice, which is a severe prejudice. Because of the district court's ruling, we were left with the claims on the balance fund and the growth equity fund as to the excessiveness of the fees in those funds. The plaintiffs produced an expert witness, Edward O'Neill, to testify as to the excessiveness of those fees. Dr. O'Neill reported that the defendants invested those funds in actively managed retail mutual funds, which charged higher fees than index.
This is a very common problem in investments. And many investment people say use Vanguard because they don't charge any fees and they use index funds. But, Fidelity has got I don't know how many funds. They're all managed. They all have customers. I don't see how you can claim this is a breach of fiduciary duty that she used managed funds. I don't understand that. I mean, it's a matter of business judgment, but it certainly isn't a matter of fiduciary duty.
Yes, Your Honor. What is unique in this case,
That's
though...
That's the trouble with your whole case. It's mostly about business judgment, as far as I'm concerned.
But it's not, Your Honor, because what's unique in this case is that the defendants went through an analysis in the mid to late 1990s and determined, with the help of the assistance of a Nobel Prize winner in economics...
Oh, I don't care about that. I mean,
but, Your Honor,
the Nobel Prize winners are better investors than non-Nobel Prize winners? I doubt it.
Well, Your Honor, the defendants believed that it was clear enough that they got out of active investment in U.S. stocks for the company's pension plan. But yet, when they made that decision that active investment was imprudent in the company's pension plan, they kept that same kind of investment in this 401k plan. Now, do they have an explanation for that? Maybe they do. They didn't offer it in this case because the case is now split up and tried in two different courts. But that's a unique circumstance. They decided, they determined it was imprudent to be in these types of investments in U.S. stocks, pulled out of it in the company's pension plan, but kept the 401k participants in it. Very different circumstance. Now,
I see that as a breach of fiduciary duty. Go ahead.
But, Your Honor, these are the exact same fiduciaries. And if these exact same fiduciaries determine...
Well, investment is a matter of judgment. There's a lot of judgment about going into this or going into that or going into the other thing.
What explains different judgments...
If we go along with your theory, there have been nothing but lawsuits for breach of fiduciary duty as a result of everyday investment decisions, it seems to me.
But that's not true, Your Honor, because most defendants would be able to offer up a reason for why they're offering what they are offering. For instance, they say, we just have a brokerage window and participants can decide what they want to invest in. But this is a different case. They knew, they determined it was imprudent to be an active investment in U.S. stocks and pulled the company's pension plan out of those investments. There's no business judgment that could possibly explain doing that for the pension plan, but not for the 401k plan.
And what happens to your argument about the cash buffer? Because now you seem to be arguing that there would be a real benefit to having a cash buffer, you know, in the sense that the buy and sell orders of the participants can be... honored without delay.
Yes, Your Honor, but the cash buffer applies only to the company stock fund. The purpose of a company stock fund is to provide employees with a way to own their employer. There's no reason to dilute that ownership interest.
It's just a hedge. I mean, you're hedging the stock. If the stock goes up, it won't go up, but the unit won't go up by as much as the stock. If it goes down, it won't go down probably as much.
Yeah.
Isn't that just a simple hedge?
It is, Your Honor. But the point of a company stock fund is not investment gains. It's to own the employer. There's no purpose in hedging that. Two, the plan does not allow...
There's no purpose in hedging that. Don't you want your employer to be as rich as possible?
Sure.
If you own it?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. And if the employer is as rich as possible because you own it, why would you want to dilute that with this cash hedge?
Well, because there's a real benefit. You can move very quickly, particularly in volatile times. Don't you wish you had more cash?
As a general matter, but in my retirement plan, no, Your Honor. And
well,
if I want
been,
to...
Been ahead of the game if you'd had a lot of cash in this account in the fall of 2008, right?
That might be, but my employer might have done well through this time, especially since I'm an employee and I want to own a part of my boss. Now,
not
also
if he's
important
poor.
To... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Not if he's poor. You don't want to own a part of your boss if he's poor.
Employees had the option to not invest in the company stock fund if they did not want to own their employer. They could have been in an interest income fund, which is a lot more conservative type fund, if that's what they chose to do. It's also important to point out, though, that the plan document does not authorize the defendants to put cash in there as a hedge. The only purpose to have cash in there is for liquidity purposes, not for hedging. So this hedging concept is something that was come up with in the course of litigation. It's not one of the purposes in the plan document, and it's not the purpose of...
But in your brief, you're criticizing this approach on the ground that if the stock goes up and you assume it's going to go up rather than down, this unit won't go up quite as much. Now, that's a hedge situation. You're complaining about the hedge.
I'm criticizing the explanation of the hedging function as an excuse for doing this. It's really important to look at, are there any meeting minutes or any other documents before this litigation started where these defendants looked at how Altria fixed the problems in this company's stock fund, and the defendants chose to keep going the way they were going and gave an explanation as to why. There is no meeting minute out there that says we need to keep cash in here for a hedge. There's no meeting minute out there that says that we're going with our way instead of Altria's way because, and listing any of the factors. These explanations that were come up with were devised by the defendant's expert witness in the course of this litigation to try to excuse the conduct that they chose to follow with no apparent explanation given. And it's important here. The Altria Company Stock Fund is virtually the exact same fund. It had the exact same problems with investment drag and transactional drag. Altria, whose fiduciaries were involved in this plan for an extended period of time, found a way to avoid those problems and save the Altria plan millions of dollars in losses each year. They told defendants about that. Here's how we fixed the problem. Here are the losses you are suffering by keeping going the way you're going. And defendants did not follow that way and did not give an explanation contemporaneously as to why they chose not to follow that example or similar examples. And that, to me, appears to be a clear breach of fiduciary duty. But importantly, on a summary judgment, it's enough to show that there's an issue of fact to be tried.
Do you mind if we go back to that retention of float? Because the defendants, as you pointed out in the brief, never did disclose the amount of State Street's compensation, including the float that it retained. But did you ever say to Judge Schenker, the defendants won't give us this information, so you should compel them to do so before entertaining their motion for summary judgment?
No, Your Honor. What we asked for was an accounting for them to provide a detailed accounting of all of that float. And the problem is that through the course of this case, we've had hotly contested discovery. In fact, we had to file a motion to compel to get unredacted versions of 400,000 pages of documents. So the discovery route to getting that information wasn't going to get us there within the time that we had.
Can I tell you something? As I was reading your opening brief, I kept waiting for you to say that only after discovery did we have the information we needed to bring in these additional defendants and these additional claims. But not until the reply brief did I see that argument. Now, I could have missed it. But the reply brief is too late in the game.
Well, Your Honor, what is the rule for the period of time that could elapse between the point at which every single fact you need to know to state a claim under Iqbal Twombly is known and you file your motion for leave to amend?
You did your opening brief to us.
Yeah, Your Honor, but the problem is getting into the trap of how much time is enough or not enough. The focus should be on where were we at this stage in the case. There were 2 months left for discovery. Defendants did not have to come up with their expert.
You are talking apples and oranges. I'm talking about why didn't you tell us about all of that in your opening brief instead of in your reply brief? And you're telling me about what went on, 2 years ago.
Your Honor, it's not in as much detail in the opening brief as the reply brief because we have a 14,000-word limit and there was a lot we had to get in. I did not see that as
more important than this.
Because, Your Honor, I saw the importance being the fact that there was 2 months left before the discovery cutoff. There wasn't a dispositive motion deadline. There wasn't a trial setting. Summary judgment wasn't filed for a year later. There was plenty of time left in this case.
I want to ask you about this record-keeping fee issue. The way I read it, the magistrate judge essentially rejected your expert's report. Your expert basically said, look, this could be done for a lot cheaper than the fees that are being this fund is paying, and I couldn't figure out what the basis that was not taken into consideration or whether it was. Can you tell me about
that? I'm not sure the basis why that expert opinion was ignored either, Judge. This was the only individual who had any experience actually doing record keeping for 401k plans of any of the experts
said,
in this case.
As I understand, you got to go out for bids every time you look at this particular expense. Is that right?
He said two basic things. He said that you should bid it out at least 3 to 5 years, every 3 to 5 years. And two, he stated that based on his experience as a record keeper, this plan could have gotten these record keeping services performed for $27 per participant.
So basically he's saying that they're violating the prudent person rule by paying so much. Isn't that what he's saying?
He's saying that they violated the prudent person rule by not putting it out for bid. To get a competitive bid.
Now, if you put it out to bid, of course, the person the outfit that's supplying the service is going to know that they're going to get bid out of the way in a couple of years. It's not as attractive business, perhaps, as others, and they'll probably charge you a higher price because they'll figure they're going to get kicked out in 2 years.
Your Honor, I think it's the exact opposite. Knowing that someone else.
All these things have another side to them. That's the problem with your argument, it seems to me.
They didn't bid this thing out since 1995. I mean, the market is the best determinant of what's the best fee for this plan. Hewitt has never had to compete against anyone else. So they could say, oh, we'll give you a dollar here, or we'll add you this service to make it seem like they're doing their job. But unless Hewitt knows that someone else out there might come in and say, hey, I could do this for $35, they have no motivation
maybe
to cut
they're
down.
Doing a great job for you. You know, I don't know what their performance is. You may want to keep them.
It may be, Your Honor, but it's the participants who are paying this money, not the defendants. If the participants could have gotten the same services for less had defendants done their job, how's that not a breach of fiduciary duty?
Well, that's all good theory, but we're talking about the practical world here.
Well, then you can never challenge a record-keeping fee in the plan, Your Honor.
I mean, your argument is that it created a genuine issue of fact. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There was a battle of experts here, one of whom, ours, actually had record-keeping experience. That creates a dispute of fact. The only way for the district judge to resolve that was to hear from the experts, hear them undergo cross-examination, and testing their opinions, and then make a decision as to who is correct in terms of the standards and whether it was breached. Here, the judge basically tried the case instead of determining whether there was a case to try.
You know you're into your rebuttal.
I do, Your Honor, and I'll stop now and save the rest. Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Morrison.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Ian Morrison. I represent the defendants of appellees in this case. And just to go back to the very beginning of what is in front of the court on appeal here, there were a number of claims that were presented in the district court. And through the summary judgment process and through the pretrial process, that was whittled down and then further has been whittled down on appeal to leave three claims that the district court decided, the claim regarding the company stock fund, cash buffer, the claim regarding Hewitt's record-keeping fees, and the claim regarding float. And as to all three of those claims, they're challenged under ERISA's duty of prudence, and for some of them, the obligation in ERISA to ensure that service providers for plans are paid reasonable compensation.
But on the claim involving the expert O'Neill, I mean, you can't really expect them to argue a summary judgment when their expert's gone. So it's not really fair to say that that's not before us, is it?
Certainly they have raised that issue, and I'm not saying that that's not part of this appeal. They have raised that issue on appeal. Our point as to the mootness of that issue is that absent, aside from O'Neill's report, the plaintiffs presented no evidence that would have supported a claim for excessive fees for those two investment options, none of the backup facts.
Once the court excluded their key evidence, there is no basis for their claim. So, you know, I mean, we can talk about the merits, whether or not the judge acted within his discretion, but I certainly would not agree with you that the plaintiffs waived this contention by abandoning their excessive fees claim.
Well, on the speaking of the merits, Your Honor, I mean, I will grant that the issue has been raised on appeal, and certainly it appears it will be decided. On the merits of this claim, Judge Shankier looked carefully at Mr. O'Neill's report. And that report related to an argument that these two investment options were imprudent because they were actively managed mutual funds, and that actively managed mutual funds are more expensive as a type than passively managed funds. And Judge Shankier concluded that the issue raised in the complaint was simply an excessive fee claim, that the fees for these funds or any funds in the plan were too high compared to other similar funds. And the O'Neill report simply doesn't address that. There's no comparison in the O'Neill report between what you can pay for the growth equity fund through American Century versus what you could pay for a comparable Fidelity fund.
You know, speaking about comparisons, you need to help me out on something, because you say that the plaintiff's challenge is to the unitized fund per se, but the plaintiffs say, nope, we're challenging the way in which these defendants decided to structure this plan's unitized funds. And Judge Shankier's understanding of the claim seems closer to the plaintiffs than to yours. So who's right here?
Well, our position is that their claim that they raised throughout the case and that they described in answers to interrogatories and that they presented largely through their expert report, Dr. Miller, was a claim that unitized funds are inherently inappropriate. For example, Dr. Miller took the position that any cash in a company's stock fund was inappropriate. And we feel that it was clear and it was undisputed that this way of operating a fund like this is typical and therefore acceptable under ERISA Section 404. But as you point out, Judge Shankier examined and thoroughly went through the claim that was presented and has been presented on appeal about the comparison between the Altria and the Kraft plans. And on that claim, we feel that he correctly granted summary judgment because, as counsel has pointed out, the issue concerning the impact of a cash buffer on the performance of these funds was raised internally. And after Altria made the decision for their 401k plan to switch to this real-time trading system offered through Fidelity, which was the record keeper for their plan, the record is full of evidence that the Kraft personnel who were responsible for this did, in fact, look at whether it was possible to adopt a similar approach with their record keeper. And it's important to keep the difference in record keepers in mind because Fidelity served the Altria plan. Fidelity had an existing product that was called real-time trading. That's a trademarked name for this service that they offer. Hewitt, which provided record keeping for the Kraft plan, did not have a product that existed like that, and it's quite evident from the record that they didn't have this product. And there was a lot of discussion of the pros and cons of using unitized funds versus some other type of system. And as the court noted, you know, there were benefits to unitized funds in terms of the cash buffer providing a hedge if there's a market fall, the ability to move immediately from...
Did you raise a Daubert challenge to Mr. Johnson, their expert on the on the record-keeping Hewitt's fees. Did you raise a Daubert challenge?
We did not. We argued that his opinion, assuming it satisfied Daubert, was simply irrelevant, and I think that that's what Judge Shanker...
Well, how can it be irrelevant if he says you can do it just as well for $20 per person cheaper? I mean, how can that be irrelevant? I mean, it seems to me that basically Judge Shanker just sort of weighed the credibility of that and blew it off, and I can't figure out how he could have done that.
Well, I think what Judge Shanker did is look at what Mr. Johnson's qualifications were and what his specific opinion was.
Yeah, there's no Daubert. He's an expert. His qualifications are there. You got to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff on a summary judgment motion. I don't see how he can just say, oh, this guy isn't so qualified. You didn't challenge him, and he's an expert. So,
well, perhaps I misspoke when I said qualifications, but what his opinion was that his company, Johnson & Associates, which at the time didn't exist anymore, could have provided record-keeping services at $20-some dollars.
Well, the guy said he could. The guy said he could. So you have to take that as true. How can he say that's not true? It's in the record. It's a plaintiff's expert.
And it was undisputed that his firm had never provided services to a plan
of
this
sort. So what? He says he can do it. I mean, on summary judgment, we're not supposed to weigh the credibility of experts or reject one expert. Isn't that Rule 26? Isn't that... Or Rule 56, isn't that pretty basic?
Well, the court, you're right. The court is supposed to take the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. But the facts here were that the company, that Kraft was considering repeatedly throughout the time that Hewitt was engaged, whether there was another provider that they would be satisfied with in terms of service level and capability.
I thought Johnson had never dealt with a company as big as this.
He had never dealt with a plan like this. His proposed $27 didn't include all of the services that Hewitt provided. The undisputed evidence on summary judgment...
So he hasn't even raised a genuine issue of fact on his report?
Correct.
You don't think that's enough to get a factual issue?
That's correct, because he was opining that he believed he could provide these services, but one of the undisputed pieces of evidence in the record was that the Kraft fiduciaries would have demanded a service provider that had a track record of serving large 401k plans and providing...
So if the plaintiffs had an affidavit from someone with record-keeping experience with a very large plan, and that expert said Hewitt's fees are much too high, would that have been enough in your mind to avoid summary judgment on that claim?
It may well have been. Obviously, we don't know what that would have been, but I think that would be a dramatically different situation than the one we were confronted with, which was that the affidavit of somebody who had never done this kind of work asserting that he could do it.
How can someone be an expert for the first time in your mind?
Well, they can be an expert by training and experience. I mean, As Judge Adelman noted, we did not file a Daubert motion asserting that this gentleman was, you know, offering junk science. The point simply was he was offering an opinion that he could have served a small to medium-sized 401k plan with his company. And the question was, would the fiduciaries operating a large, you know, 40 to 50,000 participant 401k plan with extreme demands on the record keeper have used his company? There was no evidence that there was another
provider. Didn't the Department of Labor report support his position, too, by saying that the more participants you get, the cheaper it should be? And then after the Nabisco merger, didn't go down. It just kept going up.
Well, the Department of Labor report, I think, is ambiguous on the question of what exactly they were considering. There's not a detailed description of the kind of services that they're talking about, so I don't think that's entitled to very much weight. And at the history of the negotiations with Hewitt over the years included a number of reductions in fees and increases in services, including after the Nabisco merger. And plaintiffs have argued that the fees were simply kept the same, that we ignored Buck's advice to seek reductions. And the record evidence was that the contract with Hewitt in 2000 was renegotiated to include a provision that fees would be readdressed if there was a merger of additional participants.
They never really went down, or they didn't go down very much. I mean, they were still in the 50, $55, $58 per participant range. Isn't that fair, even though they got hundreds of or thousands of more participants in the plan?
They did stay in that range, yes. But they did go down. And the duty...
See, I don't see how that doesn't create a fact issue as to whether that's a prudent person rule, violation of a prudent person. When you got somebody who says, we can do it for $20 less, I have trouble with that.
Well, as the judge focused on in his decision, there was contemporaneous evidence from experts in this field, Bach and Gildner, who had been retained at various points throughout the life of this arrangement to opine on whether or not the fees were in line with the market. And I think those were perhaps the most important pieces of evidence to Judge Schenker, because they showed that somebody who was working in this field at the time had been asked the question, how much should we be paying and are we paying too much? And came back to say,
so he's weighing the evidence then? Is that what he's doing?
Well, there was no counter to that. He wasn't weighing the evidence. He was taking the undisputed evidence about what Bach and Gildner had opined and using that to find as a matter of law that there had been no breach of fiduciary duty.
How come Altria was so much smarter than Kraft?
Well, the simple fact, I don't know that I would agree with that characterization, but
Your opponent said that they had the same problem and Altria had a better solution than Kraft, and that proves his case.
I think that's mischaracterizing the evidence here. The Altria plan, and I think counsel is referring to a memorandum from Sander Hind that's in the summary judgment record, which addresses the impact of the cash buffer and other factors on the performance of the Altria stock fund. And there were two stock funds, the Kraft Fund and the Altria Fund. And if you look at the memo, the difference between the two is quite dramatic. They conclude that the cost for the Altria plan is something like $775 a year per participant, and it's in the $100 range for the Kraft participants. So that's one significant difference. The other difference is that Altria had a record keeper, Fidelity, that offered an existing solution to this problem. And they were able, without changing record keepers and without going through an extremely complicated process, to have that record keeper simply adopt this service for them.
Do you agree that the plaintiffs were entitled to disclosure of how much State Street was compensated, including the float?
I am not entirely certain that they ever asked that question in discovery. Certainly, as we pointed out, we produced documents to them identifying the amount. And, in fact, the deposition transcript of Michael Dolson, who was the company's 30B6 witness, reflects that he was asked the question, do you know how much State Street received in float? And he testified, yes, I've seen yearly numbers. He was asked about monthly. There was never a follow-up question. How much was that? The evidence was out there. It's not our job to present it.
What is the float? Can't you have a controversy on that point?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, the complaint is you didn't disclose the float. I'm just saying if you disclose something as a float, is everybody going to agree that that is in fact a float?
I think it's
debate about how much float is a float.
I think it could be debated. I mean, it's important to remember what the claim here was. The claim was that trustee
depends on the interest rate.
Right. So forth, yeah. The claim was the trustee was paid too much money, and float was a component of its compensation, along with a base fee and various unit fees for doing certain things.
Well, is there evidence in the record that the defendants knew and monitored the amount of the float?
There's evidence that they knew the amount of the float. There's evidence from Mark Warner that was undisputed that he also was aware, he was Mike Dolson's counterpart, that he was aware of the retention of the float and had made the judgment that I think his words were, it all comes out about the same in the end, that if you demanded to keep the float, which the trustee in the normal course would keep, the trustee would charge you more for cutting checks and other services. And, in fact, that's what their fee schedules explicitly said. If we are keeping the float, if you negotiate with us that you keep the float, we will charge you more for these other items. And the question was whether it's an appropriate judgment for the fiduciaries to reach that in the end it was not worth pursuing. And our position is that it was an appropriate judgment, that that was reasonable exercise of their discretion as fiduciaries. And there's also no evidence in the record that there was any other trustee in the country, let alone one who could have served a plan of this sort, that would have charged any different price. And ultimately the challenge was, you are paying too much for the trustee services. There was no evidence presented by the plaintiffs that there was another trustee, Northern Trust, for example, that would charge you less, or to whom the float would have less value. And really, float is the value to the bank of being able to keep this money for a certain period of time. Without that evidence, there's simply no way that the plaintiffs could prove their float claim. I want to address briefly the plaintiff's motion to amend. As the court noted, the standard here is an abuse of discretion, and it's quite one thing for this court to disagree with what Judge Shankier did. It's another thing to find abuse of discretion. And Judge Shankier was the best suited person to assess whether the plaintiffs should be allowed to amend, because he had been living through this case at this point for almost a year and a half. And he was aware of the discovery that was going on. He had in front of him a fully briefed class certification motion. He had studied the issues and issued a carefully thought-out decision, taking into account all the relevant factors. And plaintiffs' counsel have accused him of simply finding that delay was enough to justify denial of the amendment, but I think it's important to keep delay, which there was here, separate from the prejudice that would have resulted to the defendants and to the court system by allowing 21 new parties into this case, which would have entailed a rebriefing of class certification, certainly additional discovery, presumably additional motion practice. And this court's cases have recognized that those factors are factors which can be taken into account by a court in denying leave to amend. I also want to note that on the company stock fund claim, there's an important point that the district court didn't reach in its analysis, and that is, or actually two important points. Those are the statute of limitations, first of all, which is a three-year statute of limitations that runs from the date of knowledge of the facts of the transaction at issue. And here, the facts of the transaction, namely that this was a unitized fund, had been disclosed for years. Participants were aware of that fact and aware of the differences in performance and therefore could have brought this claim long ago. And for the same reason, 404C of ERISA, which is a safe harbor that applies in this case, was only ever challenged based on lack of disclosure, and the disclosure claim has not been raised on appeal. 404C provides that where participants control investment decisions, losses resulting from that control are their responsibility and not the responsibility of the fiduciaries. And it's undisputed that the participants here were under no compulsion to invest in the company stock funds. And, in fact, if they wanted to invest in
Let's say they chose to invest in company stock funds. That doesn't immunize you from a mismanagement claim, does it?
Well, I think it does under 404C, so long as they had the choice to invest in those funds.
So they say, we're going to invest in this company stock fund, and you guys do something totally imprudent, or that's okay. They're out of luck.
Well, I think on the facts of this case, the situation that is causing the claim, the use of the cash buffer, was disclosed to them. They knowingly entered into these investments, and therefore the fiduciaries are not responsible for losses that they suffered. I see that my time is about up, unless the court has any further questions. Thank you.
Your Honor, as to the record-keeping fee claim, what bolsters Mr. Johnson's opinion is that their own consultant, Buck Consulting, told them that at 40,000 participants, the fee should be $35, not the $58 they had as of 2004. So that's even more powerful evidence that there was at least a dispute of fact here.
Who's that person who told
Buck Consulting.
Buck?
Yes, Buck Consulting, the first consultant they hired in 2000.
What do you say to this point about this testimony, this fellow that gave the testimony only dealt with much, much smaller funds as opposed to this one, which was a big one?
He personally dealt with Adobe International's 8,000-person plan. His company dealt with plans that were at 60,000 and more participants, which is comparable to this plan. And what he did was take his personal experience and his institutional experience and mapped it over to this plan to explain the differences in what this plan provided and how his experience applied to that. And defendants did not challenge that under a Daubert motion. So his opinion was at least relevant. It certainly was credible and admissible by defendant's own admission, and that makes at least a dispute of fact to be resolved at trial. Now, as to the float.
Well, you know, we're talking about breach of fiduciary duty, not just who's got the better business judgment. That's the problem I have with some of your case.
Your Honor, I understand, but it's not just business judgment.
I mean, we're arguing about how much you pay for this service, right?
How did you arrive at that contract? You have never bid this thing out since 1995. That's fairly damning evidence that you're not paying close enough attention to the contract. Now,
is there any evidence of improper motive in that decision? The matter was discussed, as I understand it.
But it has to be more than improper motive. It has to be... ERISA requires that these fees be reasonable. It's explicit in the statute. Plaintiffs, as participants in the plan, are entitled to challenge whether these fees were reasonable. They provided evidence that these fees were unreasonable because it was never bid out and because their own consultant said they should have been a lot lower.
Just because they discussed it doesn't mean that it doesn't immunize them from not being prudent, does it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They need to come up with the reasons why they decided to do what they did, and then the judge decides, have you performed your stringent fiduciary duties by considering those reasons. My time's expired.
Mm-hmm. Is that a question?
No, it is expired unless there were any more questions. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you to Mr. Wolf, and thank you to Mr. Morrison. The case will be taken under advisement. Thank